President, and this is not yet the show. We have a great lineup. We're incredibly happy to be here once again in Aspen, and before all of you. And before the show begins, to warm us up, to warm you up, we have a great band from my home borough of Brooklyn. I guess I could call them my homies if I were that kind of person, but they are from Brooklyn, and they are Elizabeth and the Catapult, and they're going to play Waiting for the Kill. I'm Kurt Anderson, and today we are in Aspen, Colorado, with a live audience in the ballroom of the Hotel Jerome. We're here for the Aspen Ideas Festival. So, what is the Ideas Festival? Well, remember the Woodstock Festival? The Aspen Ideas Festival is where all the people who were too nerdy and type A to actually go to Woodstock in 1969 go to make themselves feel special in 2007. It is a kind of a one-week summer camp with non-stop talks and panel discussions by and for masters of the universe. Like who? Well, there's Madeleine Albright this year, as well as Justice Stephen Breyer, Richard Branson, Queen Noor, the editors of Time and Newsweek, Colin Powell, and Bill Clinton. And for Studio 360 today, we've got a terrific lineup that includes not one of those people. However, we really do have an extraordinary group of talents today. I'll be talking with the writer and performer Anna Deavere Smith and the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Edward P. Jones. New York City Ballet star Damian Wetzel will tell us why he just got a master's degree from the Kennedy School at Harvard, and later, live tunes from pop stars in the making, Elizabeth and the Catapults. First up, you might know Anna Deavere Smith as the actress who played the National Security Advisor on The West Wing, but she is also a theater pioneer, crafting extraordinary plays out of verbatim interviews with real people, as in Twilight Los Angeles, her play about the 1992 Rodney King riots. And for her new work in progress, she has interviewed people all over the world, including a man named Brent Williams, who is a champion bull rider. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Anna Deavere Smith.
Word for word, from a bull rider in Shoshone, Idaho. And it's called Toughness, but it's really about optimism. And I originally learned it as a companion piece to Cornel West, the philosopher, because I think that, who talks about hope, and now Brent's going to talk about optimism. And I believe the cowboys are philosophers. So this is called Toughness. Basically, I'm an optimist, you know, basically, say I'm an optimist because, you know, sometimes it seems like I just have so much bad luck, and, you know, like, even like my wife's family is saying, you know, maybe, you ever think maybe he's just born a loser, seems like he has so much bad luck, but then when that bull stepped on my back, I could have lost my kidney. I didn't lose my kidney, so I don't think that's bad luck, I think that's good luck. So, you know, funny things like this happen. I was in the doctor's office last CAT scan. As Reader's Digest, October 2002, and there's like 7 ways to be lucky. It says if you want to be lucky, you got to be around positive people. I mean, even like my wife, you know, when I told her he's going to come out here and interview me, she's like, you know, she's just talking, she's just being nice to you, she don't want to do that, why would she do that? And then you called up and said you was going to come out here and interview me, and she went and looked you up on the internet and said, look who she is, you're not even going to be able to answer her questions. She was talking all about how, you know, I haven't been to college, so I don't know how to talk professional, you know, talking about how he's going to make me look like an idiot and everything because I don't know how to talk professional. I said, look, lady already talked to me for 4 hours. If I wasn't talking, you know, how she wanted me to talk. Anyway, I don't think I'm a born loser. Well, freedom, that's easy. I have to be a rodeo. Beauty? Well, I don't think I know what beauty is. Well, I guess that'd have to be rodeo, too. I mean, look how we are, the Ruffy family, you know, palling around, shaking hands, you know, we eat together, we ride together, racking up all our credit cards on entry fees and gas. I mean, it's just like, I mean, I don't even want to think about what it's going to be like when I'm not rodeoing no more. You know, I'd be all right, you know, I have my family, you know, I have my ranch and everything, but, you know, I guess just, I don't even want to think about what it's going to be like when that day comes. I guess it'd just be like the day my brother died. Confidence? I mean, I'm writing more out of determination than confidence. I mean, confidence is kind of like, you know, you've been on that bull before and you know you can ride him. I mean, confidence is kind of like being cocky, but in a good way. But determination is just like, fuck the form, get the horns. That's what Tuff Edelman said. He's in movie 8 Seconds. I mean, he's just like, hang on to the whistle blows, you know, like my uncle, you know, Pat O'Mealy, my wife's uncle, gave him a first cotton flinker rope. You know, he said, kid, you got more try than anybody I've ever seen. And try and determination is the same thing. I mean, determination is like, you know, a lot of guys safety up. I never safety up my whole life, and it might get me stepped on or something. But, I mean, determination is just like, it's just like, you know, you're going to hang on that bull even if you're riding upside down. Determination is like you're going to ride till your head hits the back of the dirt. Toughness? When is in West Jordan, Utah, and this bull shoved my face right through the metal chutes, and he tore my face all up, and I had to go to the rodeo that night, so I didn't want him to, you know, I had to go to the hospital, and I didn't want him to give me anesthesia, however you call it. So, you know, they sewed up my face, and then they had to straighten out my nose. And when they straighten out your nose, they take these two rods and shove them up your nose. And it feels like it's going out, you know, through the top of your brains, not the top of your head. And so everybody said it should have killed me, and they didn't even knock me out. So I guess I have a high tolerance for pain. So I guess that'd be toughness. But the good thing about it was, once they straightened out my nose, I could breathe, and I couldn't breathe since they broke my nose in the high school rodeo.
Thank you, Edgar Smith. That was Edgar Smith performing as Red Williams, who is a real-life bull rider from Idaho, about 800 miles west of here, I guess. So, who is this guy? Is he still a bull rider?
Yep, he is. You know, I don't know if he's riding this year. He did break his collarbone, he is a professional bull rider who lives in Shoshone, Idaho.
He seems like a guy who couldn't be more different from you, pretty much.
Right. Well, that's right.
How did you meet him? How did you find him?
I met him at a wedding, and I started my project, which is called On the Road, A Search for American Character, actually in the late 70s, early 80s. And at that time, I thought that I'd be interviewing bull riders and pig farmers and trout fishermen and people like that, but I kind of got sidetracked on race relations. And so it wasn't until 2000 and something or other that I met Brent at this wedding, and we've bonded.
Has he ever seen you do this?
Yes, I've brought him to New York, and he has seen me do it. In fact, I brought him to New York again recently to be in a film that I made, a short film that I made for the Tribeca Film Festival. So.
And how did he react when he saw himself?
He's seen it more than once, and he really liked it. One time he introduced me, in fact, to do it at the Sun Valley Writers Conference.
Yeah. How meta!
How meta! How meta can we be?
So he is part of this work in progress that's called Let Me Down Easy?
That's right.
Tell me about that.
Well, Let Me Down Easy is about the human body and its resilience. And in that way, it's also about mortality. But it's looking at mortality in order to look at life through a different lens and hopefully a more appreciative one. And I feel that a bull rider is a great symbol for resilience.
And that title comes from where?
It just came out of my mind.
Really? It sounds vaguely biblical.
I don't know if it's biblical. I have looked up to find out that there are songs called Let Me Down Easy, but I just thought of it.
And we are seeing that the whole piece is being performed.
The whole piece will be performed in January 9th. It opens at the Long Wharf Theater in New Haven, Connecticut.
So this is a bit of a preview.
This is, yeah, that's right.
Your whole approach to making theater, ever since I heard about it and then saw you perform, has reminded me of Studs Terkel a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
He was somebody you were obviously aware
Definitely.
Of when you started doing the work.
He's a mentor.
Really?
I call him that. I don't know what he feels about it.
And he's 95.
Born in 1912, the year the Titanic sank, greatest ship ever built, hits the tip of an iceberg, and bam, it went down. It went down, and I came up. Well, some century.
That's right. And 95, does he still have that oomph?
Well, I haven't talked to Stutz in a while. He has trouble hearing, and I think that's one reason he's been speaking so loudly. But but the last that we spoke, he has that.
You're going to have to carry on the Studs-Terkel tradition. If you...
Well, I don't know about that, but what I love about Stutz, of course, has been his incredible curiosity about America. And his book, Working, was something that we used to have in acting class. And most people thought it was like punishment to get a working, but I loved getting a working. Oh. And that was part of this process of coming to appreciate real people as dramatic.
You are also working, I understand, on a screenplay adaptation of The Known World, Edward P. Jones's great Pulitzer Prize-winning novel.
Exactly.
What I understand what drew you to the novel, as I was drawn to that novel, but what made you think, ah, this would make a good movie?
That's a really good question. I don't know, but in fact, when I read the book, I took it right to John Wells, who I knew because he produced The West Wing, and I thought that it would make a good movie. There's just great characters. It is about a black man who owns slaves. I probably should let Mr. Jones speak about his own book. But I also thought it was a great opportunity to look at that era in a different way, through a different lens.
I would love to have you read just a bit of the beginning of
that
novel.
Sure. And I should say that, talk about opposites, Mr. Jones would be like an opposite of mine, too, because he makes everything up, whereas I rely on reality. And he lives with no furniture, and I live with a lot of tables. So, should I read the title as well? Liaison, The Warmth of Family, Stormy Weather. The evening his master died, he worked again well after he ended the day for the other adults, his own wife among them, and sent them back with hunger and tiredness to their cabins. The young ones, his son among them, had been sent out of the fields an hour or so before the adults to prepare the late supper, and if there was time enough to play in the few minutes of sun that were left. When he, Moses, finally freed himself of the ancient and brittle harness that connected him to the oldest mule his master owned, all that was left of the sun was a 5-inch long memory of red orange laid out in still waves across the horizon between two mountains on the left and one on the right. He had been in the fields for all of 15 hours. He paused before leaving the fields as the evening quiet wrapped itself about him. The mule quivered, wanting home and rest. Moses closed his eyes and bent down and took a pinch of the soil and ate it with no more thought than if it were a spot of cornbread. He worked the dirt around in his mouth and swallowed, leaning his head back and opening his eyes in time to see the strip of sun fade to dark blue and then to nothing. He was the only man in the realm, slave or free, who ate dirt. But while the bondage women, particularly the pregnant ones, ate it for some incomprehensible need, for that something that ash cakes and apples and fatback did not give their bodies, he ate it not only to discover the strengths and weaknesses of the field, but because the eating of it tied him to the only thing in his small world that meant almost as much as his own life.
That's Anna Deavere Smith reading from The Known World. In the next 50 pages, we meet a dozen major characters, and the novel is told variously from their points of view. This must be an incredible challenge to work into the economical form of a screenplay.
It is, but at least the material that I get to work with is, in a way, like the soil that is described here, and I guess I feel like Moses every time that I open up the book and look at a clause and see it anew, and my mouth hangs open or my eyes water, because it's just so beautiful, word for word, line for line.
Can't wait to see the movie. I know you have to go to be at another venue at the Ideas Festival. I want to thank you very much for stopping into 2 to 360.
Thank you for always believing in my work, Kurt. Appreciate it.
Is an actress in Twilight Light and a certified MacArthur genius, just like my next guest, Edward P. Jones, the author of The Known World. The book is Jones's first novel, and he won the Pulitzer for it. His latest book is a collection of stories called All Ann Hager's Children, which is set in the black communities of Washington, D.C. Please welcome Edward P. Jones. So when you hear your work read aloud or performed, do you take it in differently than when you read it?
It's rare that I hear someone else reading my work. And it's as if I can step back and appreciate it in a different way. It's almost as if I want to shake the hand of the person who wrote it.
Well, now's your opportunity. Do you have, as this... Anna DeVere Smith's screenplay works its way toward completion. Do you have a dream director, dream actors in mind for this film?
No, I don't. I wrote the book, and the book is itself, but everything after that is in a different world, and I never even had one thought about anything beyond that.
Really?
No.
Even though you're a movie, I understand you're a big movie lover.
But if it were someone else's book, I might have a lot of ideas. Because it's mine, I don't.
And even now that it's on its way to becoming this, you've suppressed that impulse that other more vain authors sometimes indulge.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote the book, and in order to just get on with the rest of my life, I have to put it on a shelf and go about something else, which is what I did when I embarked on writing the stories in All Ann Hager's Children.
For The Known World, did you pile on the research?
No, did no research.
Literally no research?
No.
The language, you just sort of figured that's how they talked?
Well, before the idea even came to me, in the 60s I had read, for example, the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, other novels, then Roots came along in the 70s. So in the early 90s, when the idea for the novel did come to me, I had a sense of what the world looked like back then, you know? Small things. People aren't walking around with Rolexes. Large things, people had to guide themselves at night with the moon.
But those the census figures that you cite, and actually there's a scholarly work you cite, that's all just out of your head.
When I knew that I wasn't going to use a real county, and that I had to rely on my imagination and make my own, I had to come up with things that a reader would believe in, and I started with the census. And along the way, added imaginary historical books about this particular place.
And it's interesting when one comes across that as a reader, and you're suddenly popping into a reference to a professor, fictional professor, in their fictional 1979 book. Similarly, as you're reading along, you often will jump forward 50 or 80 years as you're introducing a character, saying, "And this is how they die."
Yeah, I think, and again, a lot of that wasn't conscious. Like when I sat down to write, everything was there in a very general way. But I've come to realize that I was dealing with people, of course, who lived 150 years ago. And I think of time as one long strip. And that in order for the reader to see and understand and believe in the people that I'm writing, I have to pick along that strip. And so if it means I'm talking about a girl who's 6 years old at the beginning of a paragraph, I'm fine, but before the paragraph ends, if I need to tell you more about her, then I leap 90 years and say, this is how she's going to die.
Without saying, spoiler alert.
Because in a sense, she sort of disappears after that.
Yeah.
But I once wrote a story called The Night Rhonda Ferguson Was Killed, because I didn't want people to be surprised at the end of what happened to this woman. It's all about the journey. It's all about the journey of getting there.
This novel brought a lot of attention to this little known fact that there were black people who owned, free black people who owned slaves. Did you get any, was that a controversial decision after the book came out and brought all this attention? Were there people who thought, oh, God, I wish you would have kept this under the rug?
No, the people, I've heard that from maybe two or three people, but those are people who had not read the book, and once they did read the book, the response was very different, I must say.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I understand you worked full-time for many years for a magazine, a trade magazine called Tax Notes. And even after your success with your first book of stories, which received awards and lots of attention, how did you have the time? One can imagine a short story, but how did you have the time having this full-time journalistic job doing the known world?
Well, I was essentially summarizing newspaper and magazine articles on taxes. And I was working at home. I've been working at home since 86, so I could arrange my day the way I wanted. And that meant when I wanted to write, when I needed to write, I could get up in the morning and do that, and do the dry stuff in the afternoon and evening.
And was there a point at which you felt, okay, the world is taking note of me, my books are selling, I can quit this day job?
No, I was working at Tax Notes after Lost in the City came out, and when I finally decided it was time to work on the known world, I took 5 weeks of vacation. And 2 weeks into the vacation, they fired me after 19 years. After 19 years of working there, and they gave me 2 months severance. When Lost in the City came out, when I was interviewed, I never once hesitated to tell them where I was working. After The Known World came out, I never hesitated to tell people what they had done to me.
Good for you. And I don't suppose you read tax notes these days.
Goodness, no. That's a necessary thing for tax accountants and lawyers. For those nerds. And I'm a nerd, but I'm not one of them.
I think you're a different flavor of nerd, I guess. Would you read from one of your stories, the one called Tapestry?
Yes. This is about 1932-33, and this couple is newly married and leaving the new wife's home. Just before the train with the newly married couple left Mississippi, it stopped at a patch of a place so small no one had bothered to give it a name. The entire train was full, and that first cabin, which got most of the smoke and soot from the engine, had only colored people. George, the sleeping car porter, would work most of the trip to Washington. And settling into being Mrs. Carter, got to know many of her neighbors in her cabin. No one in that first leg of the trip, save her and George, was destined for lives in Washington. The other future Washingtonians were picked up along the way, farther north in Mississippi, and then in places east, especially St. Louis. At that patch of nowhere in Mississippi, three colored people got off, and a pregnant Negro woman and a white man got on. They were married, though none of the Negroes knew that. Instantly, there rose in their hearts a disdain for the white man and a you hold put upon thing attitude for the woman, who was some 7 or 8 months in the family way. They waited for the white man to leave, perhaps to go to one of the cars for whites, or, more likely, to leave the train altogether. After all, it had its pleasure. But he followed the woman to a seat 2 down and across from Anne. He stored 2 suitcases above the seat. When she was seated, he helped the woman take off her shawl and folded it and made a pillow for her head. Then he knelt, unhooked her shoes, and began to massage her stocking feet. The Negroes could see that they were not yet 30. The train's engines snorted right and left, shimmied, and then started up. In 5 blinks of Anne's eyes, it was on its way. The seat of the Negro woman, accompanied by the white man, was facing Anne, who saw the woman with her head still leaning back, her eyes closed as the man worked her feet in his hands. The Negroes around the couple, some standing, some sitting, were silent, and they, all but the smallest children, looked at one another. Maybe he was not really white. He took a pair of yellow slippers from his coat pocket and put them on the woman's feet. He stood and took off his hat and nodded to just about every Negro head in the car, and then he removed his coat. The man took the seat at the window beside the woman and disappeared from Anne's view. The Negro woman's head was still back, and she opened her eyes before long and smiled at the older couple in the seats facing hers and the white man's. Then she looked at the white man and smiled. The oldest person in the car, the woman of the couple facing the Negro woman and the white man, asked them in a voice many heard, "Y'all going far?" The pregnant woman nodded and smiled some more. "Yes, ma'am." They knew he was white when the conductor came in 20 minutes later and said in a loud voice, in a voice white people had for each other when they knew one was making a mistake in the presence of Negroes, "You sure you this where you want to be?" "I'm sure," the white man said. Many of the adults in the car would live to see the first man on the moon, and a good bunch of those would never believe it had happened. That scene with the white man and the Negro woman was far more incredible. But those who believed would do so because the scene on the train had come to them unfiltered, without the use of some camera operated by the space people out to try to trick their eyes.
Most of your stories are somewhere, broadly speaking, in the middle of the 20th century, most of them set in Washington, D.C. Is that a matter of the old dictum of writers should write what they know?
No, when an idea for something comes to me, it's almost always in the 50s or the 60s. I think because that's when I was coming of age, the world became more and more colorful. I can't really imagine stories for the most part in the 80s or 90s. There was a great deal of light that I was discovering in the 50s and 60s. And whenever I see a woman walking down the street, she's almost walking in a 1950s dress.
You are now an international literary superstar. I told me a few minutes ago you just got back from Milan. How has it been going so quickly from the very little-known tax writer in Washington to being this great, big literary celebrity?
It's been very nice. but up until recently, I tried to just, you know, live the kind of simple life that I had, because there is a danger, of course, that you become the person who did not write the books. And so, up until recently, when it started getting hot in Washington, I would get out with my suitcase if I was going somewhere and catch the bus at my apartment building and go to the Red Line, which would take me to the Blue Line to the airport, and get on the plane and do the same thing coming back. I didn't leave my apartment with a cape, with an entourage. It was just me and my suitcase. And it'll be like that forever.
So you think keeping it real is a matter of willed achievement?
Yeah. There was a comment made by some guy, I forget his name now, he was in that Pitt movie. He was up for the Academy Award and he was interviewed on Nightline. And he said that fame and fortune doesn't change people. It just unmasks them, and I think that's true.
Edward P. Jones, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me.
Edward P. Jones is the author of All I Have Your Children and Another World.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360. We are at the Aspen Ideas Festival in Aspen, Colorado. And in a minute, we may make some men in the audience a bit uncomfortable. All you mama's boys know who you are. That is the title of a song coming up from Elizabeth and the Catapult in just a minute. Stay with us.
Yeah.
This is Studio 360, and we are in the ballroom of the Hotel Jerome in Aspen, Colorado. I'm Kurt Anderson. Our show today is part of the Aspen Ideas Festival, which is a week of big names and big ideas. So naturally, the average age of the participants is, well, this event makes me feel youngish almost. So our next guest represents Studio 360's commitment to the MySpace demographic. Here are Musical Brooklyn's brightest young things, Elizabeth and the Catapult, with a song called Mama's Boy.
Who expected me to cook a lot better than their moms. That didn't really happen. But actually, this rings truer with a lot of the men in the audience. At multiple shows, guys come up after the show and just say, "You pinned me, that's me." So,
really?
It's interesting.
That's depressing.
It's depressing.
Are you able now to spot them ahead of time?
Oh, yeah. Miles away.
Really? Telltale signs are...
Telltale signs are I think it's just everybody is
being a young man, I guess. Okay. How did this band get started?
Well, actually, a bunch of us went to Berklee College of Music.
In Boston.
But at the time, a lot of my college career, I was on tour with Patty Austin, so I didn't actually meet any of them until after college. We all kind of moved to Brooklyn at around the same time, and we're all kind of wandering musicians, and we just kind of clicked instantaneously.
Berklee has produced over the last couple of decades lots of people who have become well-known pop stars. After having this classical education, was there ever any doubt that this is the route you'd go?
I don't think there was really ever a doubt. I mean, as a child, I was locked away in a room practicing WC and Chopin, and if I hadn't discovered Bob Dylan or Joni Mitchell, I probably would still be doing that. But
And you grew up in the Village, didn't you?
I grew up down the block from Café Wa and Fat Black Pussycat, where they started their careers.
But long after, needless to say, they started their careers.
Now they sell fake IDs or something.
Do you see yourself in some kind of recent lineage of these smart piano-playing singer-songwriters like Tori Amos and Fiona Apple and Regina Spektor?
I definitely get that a lot. I actually just recently discovered that I went to Manhattan School of Music with Regina Spektor at the same time, which is bizarre, because I didn't know her. But, I mean, I take it as a compliment. I think a lot of it is, especially with Fiona Apple and Regina Spektor, it's kind of the classical influence, so that's a high compliment.
Is it challenging for you in this moment in history, in your generation, to be the leader of this band of four guys?
Wow, the feminist question. That's heavy.
It's the Aspen Ideas Festival. We have to pretend to be serious.
I think that it's always difficult to be the leader of a band, but I mean, these guys are my brothers, so they don't give me too hard of a time.
And you're in Brooklyn. There are so many bands in Brooklyn. It's like MacArthur Geniuses at the Aspen Ideas Festival. Yeah, I mean, is that a good nurturing environment to have all these people?
I think it's amazing. Right now, there's really this amazing kind of East Village community. We play shows, and every show is like this interactive experience where there's so much of the audience that are musicians and good friends of ours, and we just have people coming up and off stage, and it's really inspiring to be surrounded by so much talent.
Before we let you play again, can you introduce the rest of the band?
Definitely. We have Pete Lalish on guitar. Rob Hecht on the violin. Dan Malott on the drum. And we have Matt Wigton on bass. And actually, for this next song, Dan Malott is going to be joining me singing.
Great. What are you going to play?
This is called Porcelain Lady. It's about a deconstructing doll who's trying to put herself back together.
Let's hear it.
Crumble apart.
to align.
Porcelain lady, your body is breaking. One silent move at a time. Thousands of pieces are floating around us. Something keeps you. Something keeps you alive.
Studio360.org. Up next, that modern rarity, a visionary leader who also looks fabulous in tights, Damian Wetzel. We are at the Aspen Ideas Festival. I'm Kurt Anderson. This is Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. And today we are in the Rocky Mountains at the Aspen Ideas Festival. Pretty much everybody here in Aspen this week has a master's degree or several master's degrees or doctorates or honorary doctorates. Damian Wetzel seems to fit in with this policy wonk crowd. He graduated this past spring from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard with a master's degree in public administration. But Wetzel is also a principal dancer for the New York City Ballet, and he danced at the top of his game while getting his degree. Everyone, please welcome Damian Wetzel. This weren't radio, I'd make you dance now, but that would be pointless on a radio program.
Dancing on the radio, no good.
Exactly. So I've heard.
Dancing, perhaps.
Look, he danced. So this, I guess, is a fairly normal career path in dance. You work your way in the ballet corps.
Well traveled.
Become a choreographer. Then you go to Harvard to get a master's degree? Yeah. What's that about?
Oh, it was about so many different things, but I think probably more than anything, just curiosity and looking for new paths to take. And the little voice in the back of my head for so many years, and when you stop, ... And so when this opportunity came up, and, you know, I went and visited, and I immediately realized it was the place where I was going to get stimulated with all kinds of ideas, how to proceed, how to capitalize on what I already do, and the fact that I could dance at the same time, obviously, was just sort of unbelievable.
Well, but was it as radically different as I imagined, just being with dancers?
Absolutely.
And being with all these
superheroes? Yeah, it was kind of a school for life in some ways that way. I mean, I would arrive like everybody else and do my classes, and just so happened that by the time I'd arrived, I'd usually been in Boston taking a ballet class already and run back and, you know, got there in time for the first class or did it late at night. And, it was completely different, and just an amazing gift. I mean, I think the word luxury comes to mind.
And did you find commonalities? A dance corps is like, Afghanistan in this sense, or...
Absolutely.
Really?
No, not exactly Afghanistan. But certainly in the sense that a lot of the program that I was involved in mid-career, it's a mid-career master's in public administration, it's all about learning a new, what to do with yourself mid-career. And it seems tailor-made for someone like me, actually. And I've had an incredible career, and it's still going for a little while longer. And I've always thought, well, next I want to do something to capitalize on it, or perhaps something entirely different. So this was a place where I could kind of explore those opportunities. And I'll tell you, in a lot of the courses, you know, I didn't take any arts courses, but I took a lot of courses where I could apply everything that I knew and bring it back with me now to the arts, which was really a gift, too.
Well, and indeed, this year you became the artistic director of the Vail International Dance Festival, just up the road here, which seems like a case study, perfect for Mr.
Absolutely.
Public Policy MA. Ballet audiences are aging, tickets are expensive, the repertoire is 100 or 200 years old. It's perceived as an elitist pursuit. Do you have a 5-year plan to...
Gloomy Gus. Wow. That's bad.
Just trying to be frank.
That's right. Well, let's just say there are serious challenges in the dance world to be met. And listen, the Vail International Dance Festival is this incredible festival already. It's been around for about 15 years. And I just came on board there in October, even while I was still actually at school and dancing, so it's really juggling. But it was perfect, as you say, as a case study for how I picture the art form progressing. Because we're at a time in ballet, particularly right now, dance in general, ballet particularly, where we're coasting quite a bit on the successes of the 20th century. George Balanchine's legacy and Jerome Robbins's, or my personal legacy at New York City Ballet as a dancer. And then we're trying to figure out where we're going next, and this is an incredible wrestling match of preservation and progress and how to handle it, and audiences dwindling. We all have seen the Gloomy Gus headlines and all of that. And in Vail, I get to really try out my ideas, and what I'm doing, in a nutshell, is trying to preserve and educate the audience about the glories of the past. The company, the Pacific Northwest Ballet, is coming, and they're going to do 7 different ballets that I consider to be essentially masterpieces. Balanchine's Agon, for instance, and Twyla Tharp's Sinatra. And then on the other end of the scale, Christopher Wheeldon, most incredible young ballet choreographer, is starting his own new company, and he's going to present his new works there. So, and then in between, Sabian Glover's going to come and tap dance, so he could be a dance on radio. And so for me, that's the solution. The solution really is about education of the audience, to take them to a place where they're bought in and they want to know more. When I go to something that I don't know that much about, and I learn a little bit, I want to go back. If I just have a proscenium experience, boom, that's it, I saw it, maybe I go back, maybe I won't, I don't know. But to me, it's all about letting people in the door, let them see a little more, know a little more. My model for this, I have to say, give incredible credit to Leonard Bernstein's example. Things he did as music director of New York Philharmonic, he did this thing, Thursday nights were preview rehearsal nights, and then you'd come back on the Friday and see the actual show. I mean, it's an amazing thing. How much more do you know? after that. There's a great recording of him giving a pre-concert speech right before Glenn Gould plays the Bronze D minor, and he essentially gives a disclaimer and says, listen, we fought about this all week, you know, I can't say I'm totally in agreement with this, and, you know, he spoke so much.
Transparency, as they say at Harvard.
Transparency, exactly, and it's this fabulous moment, and the first time I heard it, you're just dying to hear it. You say, I want to know what that sounds like. So.
Well, they should, it sounds like, given you've been to Harvard, you're running this festival, you are a brilliant dancer, choreographer in your own right, shouldn't you be running the New York City Ballet?
I don't think that's available. I want to find a place for myself in the arts and public policy and directing and choreographing and being in the room, as well as trying to find a way to move forward with ideas like Mr. Bernstein's example. That's what I want to do.
Is this your first time at the Ideas Festival?
It is, yes.
And have you had any memorable encounters with geniuses, war criminals, celebrities?
I have to say, I have had an incredibly packed and full schedule in my last, I've been here for about 24 hours, and I've run into some amazing people. I mean, Justice Breyer, who is magnificent, doesn't cover it. You know, to have someone like that speaking and just his mere presence, it elevates us all. So that's an example I'll give you.
It's probably a cliche question that you've been asked a million times, but that has never stopped me before.
All cliches are true.
Well said. As a boy, was it difficult to be a serious ballet student?
Absolutely difficult in some ways, and really, you know, made you want to do it that much more in other ways. I was actually saying in a thing I did at the Ideas Festival today how one of the ways I know that education is valuable is because I watched my peers get educated and how it changed. From 7th to 10th grade, it went from some version of hazing to, hey man, are you still doing those plays? That's interesting, you know, I want to come see that sometime. And that was about learning what it was and, you know, getting past a certain point of education.
And if parents come to you and say, should my little kid, who's a good dancer, pursue a career in ballet? Are you?
Oh no, it's all very subjective. I mean, if I run a school for New York State in the summer, and I have lots of young men and women there, talent, and you know, it's very individual about you know whether you should. I mean, there's this moment at 16, 17 when you go, you don't go. What do? Because it's very hard to know whether it's right, and you have to rely on the advice of people. You know, and I would always try and be subjective. I would say, if the person is talented and they love it and they have the drive to do it, I would say, please join us.
And how did you get started? I mean, did you just, Mom, Dad, I need to dance at age 6?
Exactly.
Or? Really?
Just like that. No, I don't have one of those stories. I didn't see it on, you know, I know people who say, oh, you know, I happened to be, you know, Sesame Street ended and suddenly I saw somebody dancing on television and I had to do it. No, that didn't happen to me. I have one brother, and we both were given a number of lessons of various sorts, music lessons and dance. Ballet was in there for some reason. It's a little unclear to me exactly why, but I think it was because I was very outgoing and physical, and it was athletic stuff too. And in the end, it's what stuck is what it came down to, and I started throwing things out. I love to tell this story, so you'll indulge me for one second. My brother and I also took Chinese lessons because my father grew up in China, and he had a certain amount of foresight in this. He thought, you know, I should probably get to know Chinese. So throughout, I started at 4, and 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, I did everything. I did all these things I just mentioned. Around 10, 11, I started focusing on ballet. And I remember one morning in my family car in the back seat on Saturday morning when all these lessons sort of, you know, were jumbled together, my brother turned to me and he said, you know what? No more ballet for me. And I said, Jonathan, no more Chinese for me. And we shook hands on it. And I joined New York City Ballet in 1985. And my brother has been a director at McKinsey in China for the last years. He joined McKinsey in Hong Kong in 1984.
They're consulting for it.
Yes.
So in the biopic of your life, boy, that scene in the car is a good
one. It was a big one. You know, it's so good you can't believe it's true, but it is true.
And is your brother feeling like you're kind of cutting in on his territory now that you've been to Harvard?
No, I think he's incredibly proud. I mean, I sent him a text message from Harvard Yard during the commencement, and he was just so thrilled. You know, it was just amazing.
You are 40-ish.
40.
How close to the end of your dancing career does that make you?
Getting there. A little while longer. No, I haven't decided exactly, but...
But you're still dancing.
I'm still dancing, yeah. I'll be dancing next week in... well, I don't know when this is airing, but exactly. I'm still dancing a lot. Yeah.
Great. Damien Wetzel, thank you very much for coming into Studio 360.
It's really my pleasure.
He's dancing. Damien Wetzel is a principal dancer with the New York City Ballet. He is also directing the Vail International Dance Festival this summer here in Colorado.
You can find out more about the festival at studio360.org. I would like to thank not only Damien, but all of our guests here in Aspen, Anna DeVere Smith, Andrew P. Jones, and Elizabeth and Fred Hull, who have got one more song for us coming up. The Aspen Ideas Festival is a collaboration between the Aspen Institute and the Atlantic Monthly. Special thanks to Jamie Miller, Jim Spiegelman, and Walter Isaacson. WNYC's engineering team, Ed Haber and Irene Trudell, and WNYC program director, Chris Bannon. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. Our production team is Julie Burstein, Lital Malad, David Krasnow, Michelle Siegel, Derek John, Pike Malinowski, and Jenny Lawton. And our theme music is by David Van Tegum. Thank you very much for joining us today, and now let's close the show with Elizabeth and the Catapult.
Just so perfectly perfect, except when I'm not. I'm just so seemingly sunny till things get too hot. And we're both so foolishly naughty until we get caught. Chances are that our love is now utterly, thoroughly shut. 'Cause my life's so perfectly funny.
fill up the hole. It can cover your eyes. The aching still greets you as the morning arrives. It can bury your head when the going gets hard. How long does it take before you crumble apart?
Porcelain lady, your body is breaking.
One silent move at a time.
Thousands of pieces are floating around us.
Something keeps you alive.
Porcelain lady, your body is breaking. One silent move at a time. Thousands of pieces are floating around us. Something keeps you. Something keeps you
thank you.